This episode is brought to you by Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a new podcast, Scene on the Screen, presented by Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hey everybody, welcome to Literary Disco on Lit Hub Radio, episode 184, A Christmas Story. Today, we discuss the work of storyteller and humorist Gene Shepherd, whose book, In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, formed the basis of the classic 1980s film, A Christmas Story. This is Literary Disco, the last book club you'll ever need, where Todd, Julia, and Ryder, three old friends who love to read, debate, and sometimes even agree. I am actor and filmmaker Ryder Strong. Joining me, as always, are novelist and critic Todd Goldberg and essayist and radio personality Julia Pistel. Hi, guys.
Hey!
Hi. Nice to see you guys.
Merry Christmas.
Happy holidays.
Merry holidays and Christmases.
Happy Hanukkah ending to you, Todd.
Thank you very much. Hanukkah just ended a couple days ago. We lit all the candles. It was lovely. The greatest gift I received during Hanukkah, if I can tell you guys, was listening to the previous episode where, for some reason, you guys think I'm a monster and I'm not a Shel Silverstein fan.
Okay.
Wow.
We just took a guess.
Wow. Wow. You think I don't...
I feel like you're anti-Giving Tree, though. I feel like you've...
No,
you've
I love the Giving Tree.
Oh, really?
I love the Giving Tree. Okay. Oh, my God.
For some reason, I had it in my head that at one point you were like, this book is fucked up. And
well, it is fucked up, but...
Yeah, but in a good way. Like,
yeah, in a complex way of like, oh gosh, like this is not the way you think a children's story is going to go. I love Shel Silverstein. I love Sylvia's mother. I love his songwriting. Come on now.
Yeah. And you also have the missing piece in the Big O.
I saw when you
Rage tweeted a photo.
Yeah, well, look, you know, I had sat down and was like, oh, boy, I wonder what it's like when they record on their own. Todd's off doing Todd things. What are they like without him? I speak of myself in both third and fourth person, apparently. And within 2 minutes, the bad fucking energy starts about Shel Silverstein vis-a-vis me. I'm a huge fan. Huge fan. Massive.
All right. We made you into a straw man. Man. I'm sorry.
It's very upsetting. And I did it. I did, though, appreciate at some point in the show, you guys mentioning Cats in the Cradle.
Oh, yeah. I figured that would have come up a lot.
Yeah, that would have extended the episode from 35 minutes to 65 minutes if I had been there. Yeah.
Well, we missed you.
I missed you guys, too. I was off doing my MFA residency, which was... on Zoom, so it was not as fun as it normally is when I get to have folks like you guys come and visit. But so when we finally get to do the MFA residency in person, which hopefully is in June, but probably in December, it's going to be a bacchanal.
I was going to say, it's going to be disgusting. It's just going to become a dance club.
Yeah. It's just going to be like...
a bunch of naked people on ecstasy dancing.
Just a bunch
in
of...
in the desert.
Basically, at a resort in Rancho Mirage, just like screaming about their favorite poems.
I was going to say, the poets finally let out
of
their houses. Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, it was a good time. You know, I love Christmas time, though. And now that I've had to do residencies every year in December for the last 13 years... the hotel where we do it always has all this Christmas music playing and there's a giant tree and it really gets me in the spirit to come home and nap for 10 days and then open presents. But
incredible.
Yeah. But I missed you guys. I'm glad to be back. And I hope the listeners didn't believe you when you said that I didn't like Shel Silverstein. My God. The slander.
Sorry.
Yeah.
If you're a fan of Literary Disco, then you're a fan of stories, and you should check out Far Away, a new short story collection from Amazon Original Stories. Far Away gathers five of today's most original best-selling authors for bold new takes on classic fairy tales. These are not your typical happily ever after kind of stories. These five stories for adults offer new takes on evil queens, charmless princes, and star-crossed lovers, taking old standards in new and interesting directions. The Faraway collection is available in audio and ebook format. Amazon Prime members listen and read for free. Download now at amazon.com/faraway stories. That's amazon.com/faraway stories. Well, so interestingly, I was doing a little bit of poking around on the internet this morning on Gene Shepard, who we're talking about, and he was friends with Shel Silverstein.
No
which
kidding.
Kind of makes sense. Yeah. They actually like circle around a similar vibe as far as like storytelling and humorous. Mm-hmm. And So the book we're talking about today is called In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. It was released in 1966 by Gene Shepard, who was a radio host, an actor, a writer, and a monologuist. And it's a collection of stories reflecting on his childhood in Indiana, kind of based supposedly real, but no one really knows how real or not real it is. So, you know, where it falls in the fiction, nonfiction line. But it includes several stories that revolve around Christmas. And in 1982, the director Bob Clark adapted several of these stories to, you know, kind of combine them together to create A Christmas Story, which I don't think needs any introduction because everybody has seen it 500 million times if you've lived in America. So I thought, you know, the reason I wanted to read this is just because I was watching A Christmas Story with my son, who's right at sort of prime Christmas Story age, 6 years old. He's about to turn six. And we had watched it last year, but this year he's just been obsessed with the movie and wanting to watch it over and over again. And I realized, like, I had never talked to anybody who had read these stories. I always knew it was based on these stories, but it seems like the movie has really eclipsed Gene Shepard.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. Like the movie is bigger than him and bigger than his writing. And I always kind of wondered why or, you know, if that was fair or what. So I wanted to bring it up as something to read on our show to just talk about, you know, discover the stories, but then also have a chance to talk about the movie, which I just find kind of fascinating too.
Yeah.
And so talk about the presents that we always wanted and didn't get, obviously.
Oh, sure.
As well, because I've got a list. You know what's so funny is so I had read the Red Rider story a few years ago. I was teaching a class on adaptation, and we looked at that story, but not all the other ones. Mm-hmm. As it relates to the movie. And I had the thought then, like, oh, you know, he was sort of Sedaris before Sedaris.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And right. Then reading all of these stories, he was sort of before his time. You know, mm-hmm. Like when you read all these stories together, he really was kind of a Sedaris type writer that time forgot, or at least we forgot about, because I mean, these are subversive stories. They're deeply, deeply weird.
Yeah,
they are not quite true and not quite fiction. And I really appreciated them, but the adaptation, it's a line for line adaptation.
Yeah.
From
oh, yeah.
The stories. Like they just were like, well, let's just take these 120 pages and we'll just put interior house day on them.
Right. Well, it's also worth, we should point out Gene Shepard is the narrator in A Christmas Story.
Right.
He's the adult Ralphie. So when you hear those lines, they are sentences lifted completely from his book, but delivered with that. I just love, like, reading this, you could just hear his voice mm-hmm. the entire
yeah.
time, because we have those snippets from A Christmas Story, and yeah, it makes sense that he was a performer, you know.
Yeah,
reading this, it really helps.
Well, I've only seen A Christmas Story, I watched it last night with Greg, my husband, who's seen it 1 billion times and is like emotionally connected to
yep.
it
yep.
And that was really fun because we spent some good time analyzing why it was good or why it's a classic. But my family was, okay, so there's two 24-hour marathons on Christmas. There's A Christmas Story for the cool people, and then there's Miracle on 34th Street for everybody else. So we watched that. But, I mean, it is cool to come in with an adult point of view on the movie. I don't think being a kid is like the ideal age for the movie.
This is my
entry into the discussion.
No, it's not.
I think our age now is what the movie is about, mm-hmm. or and who it's for.
Yeah.
Like the taste of the nostalgia, the flavor of the storytelling is so good. It's so like right on being like, this is what it's like being a kid, but I also have this wry adult perspective that I can like perfectly modulate as each beat of the of the story needs. So I think when I saw it as, I probably did see it or part of it as a kid, and I was just like, this dumb boy wants a gun, right. whatever. And now I'm like, this is about how adults remember childhood.
Right.
Like, this is a fantasy of childhood. The fantasies in the movie are a deeper level, but even the nonfiction part, that's still a fantasy of childhood.
Right.
So, yeah.
I think it's the perfect family film in that it's best watched as a family, you know, because there are two, the movie jumps between two very clear perspectives of the kid and the adult, and that it satisfies both, right? Yeah. Like, so watching it, and so when you watch it as a family, it is, because I remember watching it with my parents and hearing them laugh and hearing them be like, that's exactly what it was like when I was a kid. And that was like part of the experience, is being told like, this is welcome to the Christmas ritual. You're going to want ridiculous things like a BB gun or whatever. And we're going to tell you, you can't have it. You know? And it's like, so for like Indy watching it now, he, I think, just enjoys, you know, a kid stuck his tongue on a pole and it got stuck. Santa Claus was really weird and creepy. Like, he enjoys the vignettes as sort of, you know, and then he just quotes it. Like, my son is running around going, it's a clinker. And it's like, I'm like, what happened to you? And it's like, I don't have to say anything. He'll just be like, Dad, it was soap poisoning. I'm like, how do you know lines? You know, so it's just, it's indelible. Like, the actual performance and the direction, it's incredible. And so it works on that level. But then, yeah, as a grown-up, you're watching it and going, like, there's so much irony and commentary.
Peter Billingsley is so good. He's just incredible in that role. Yeah.
He's crying throughout the whole movie. The entire movie, he is bawling and like genuinely crying. Yeah. And it's like, and then he has that moment at the end where he's like, has to whip up tears, and he doesn't. Yeah. And it's like, this kid's incredible. Yeah. This performance is just amazing.
So I think that part of the reason that I like A Christmas Story, from my current vantage point in life, is I feel like the picture of parenting is really good. Mm-hmm. Like, that they're both the parents, but particularly the mom, like, she's got that like tough nagging mom thing and the warmth, but it's both at the same time. Yeah. And the tiny, tiny moment where she sticks the soap in her mouth after she's punished her kid.
Right.
I'm like, this is perfect. It's like a jewel of a second, where we just like see her consider everything she's doing, try it out. She's curious, she's guilty, she's like everything in one. And I don't know, it's nice to see parents reduced to, you know, not reduced to caricatures, but they're complex.
Right.
I think it's such a, like, yeah, that it, watching it the last 2 years has really just blown my mind about how much the movie gives to the parents, you know, like, and how much of the movie is actually this sort of debate between the two parents, and you know, like the battle of the lamp.
I love that.
You
one.
Know, the way that I was thinking about, I actually think she wins the contest for him, because in the beginning she's the one who calls. He's like trying to do some newspaper thing, and it's like, what's the name of the Lone Ranger's cousin's horse? And she's like, everyone knows that, and says it. And I think that's the answer that wins him the lamp. And so it's like, she's the unsung hero. Like, the dad has all the power in the household, but he is a mess. And she's the one, like, the moment where they're like, my mother had not had a warm meal in 30 years, you know, because she's like constantly cooking the food. But she's also the one who is. So I was watching it, like, so much of the movie is about Ralphie wanting to, like, have access to the world of men. Like, to be able to talk to his dad, essentially.
Right.
Like, there's so, I mean, that wanting the BB gun is about wanting to be a man. Like, wanting to have, you know, some access to this world of, like, older masculine traditions. And the whole time, it's like, he's terrified of his father. Like, And his mom is the one who's like, you know, go help your dad with the car. You know,
right.
He's like, goes outside, and his dad's like, what are you doing here? And he's like, mom said I could maybe. And he's like, no. Okay, fine. Help me. And then he swears and gets in trouble, right? The oh fudge scene. And it's like, then the problem is he's going to be killed by his father. Like, and when his mom says, where did you hear that? He can't say from my dad, who taught me how to swear and is swearing all the time. And so, I don't know, it's just this really interesting. And then, like, you know, when he gets into his first fight, his mom saves him, and his mom covers for him and lies to his dad, because otherwise, like, I guess the implication is that his dad would beat him, or...
There is an undercurrent of possible abuse.
Yeah.
That exists.
His brother hides under the sink because his dad's going to kill Ralph.
Right. Flick is constantly hiding under things when dad's around.
Yeah. Mm. And then, like, you know, Schwartz, the neighbor, gets beat up by his parents when he lies because he can't admit that his dad's the reason. Anyway, the point, like, at the end, his dad is the one who gives him the BB gun.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's like, all this movie, he's been manipulating and trying to, and he never talked to his dad about it. Like, he never asked his dad. And his dad just gave it to him. And then, of course, he shoots his eye out. So the irony is, like, welcome to the world of men, and you're not, and it's not great. Like, it's awful.
I mean, there's also the sort of the peanutsification of his father. Like, the idea that the father's never paying attention, doesn't see because the kid's scared of him. So therefore, the father's the want, and can't see him. Of course, like, the father is probably not as frightening as he seems.
Right.
Why would the wife stay with him? They seem to have this tender moment over the leg, you know? Yeah. Like, there are these scales of reality here. And, you know, the father coming home and having 8 glasses of wine, you know, or whatever it might be, always reading the paper.
Well, even just the fact that he's called the old man.
Right.
He doesn't have a name. The father is just the old man.
Who is probably 40.
Yeah.
So there's that.
Or younger.
And he's probably 36. But, you know, the thing that I also find interesting and amusing is, like, that era, that's Main Street Disneyland. Like, that's the era that they're trying to show you, that they're trying to sell you.
Go ahead, Julia. Finish your thought. All right. So reading the book reminded me and pulled me directly into this question, and I had to start Googling my ass off. This takes place in the Depression.
Yeah.
I know, I couldn't believe that.
Yeah.
So this is not Main Street USA. I was like, this is great, because there's a shabbiness to the house.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
There's a shabbiness to their life, and, like, everybody wants things and they're trying to get free shit. And in the book, there it's hit hard, like, how snazzy Ovaltine is.
Right.
And I like that element. Like, I've always thought of this as a 50s setting.
Me too.
But it's
never
not.
Occurred
it's
to
a
me.
1940.
Yeah.
1940. Even.
Yeah, I think the book is very clearly in the Depression. I think the movie is a little bit more nebulous as to the exact time.
Sure.
Which is, you know, which makes it sort of classic Americana, right?
But it's radio, not television.
Right. But when
it's, it's definitely pre-40s.
Right.
Or right on the cusp of the 40s. It's,
but when you think about,
I never realized.
When you think about the sort of shabby, weird neighbors, everyone's super poor, they're eating out of the garbage, you know, like.
Yes.
Like, it's not a time of prosperity. And those, the poor people, the super poor people are portrayed as villains. And then, of course, you think about it, you're like, well, they're portrayed as villains because they didn't have anything. They were stealing to eat, you know? Mm. So there's a lot of complexity that's involved in this beyond just a simple Christmas story.
Well, I feel like the book really brings out a lot of those issues. It's a truly strange book.
Yeah.
I found this I found it very unsettling to read, and I'm not quite sure. Honestly, like, because it's, I mean, so it's structured in this really weird, kind of hokey way, where it's like the narrator, Gene Shepard, is going back to his hometown in Indiana from New York City, and he's sitting at a bar, and he runs, alarm going off in my pocket. He runs into his old buddy Flick, who's now a bartender at Flick's Tavern, and he just spends the day drinking there. And that is, like, the frame for these little monologues or these little interludes. And it's kind of weirdly, I don't know. What I really liked about it was how much by the end, especially class, like the things you guys are talking about, really rose to the forefront. And kind of brought out some of the things that bother me about A Christmas Story, the movie, kind of made them make sense and contextualize them in a really cool way. But then there's other parts of this nostalgic tone. And the sort of, like, oh, shucks, good old boy, that is really weird, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, when it talks about women, especially, like, and girls and dating.
Yeah.
And, And like, you know, and you realize how sort of limited this worldview is. And I don't know, like it made me uncomfortable at times. It was like, well, are we but really also, nostalgic for this?
I mean, contextually, of course, this came out in 1966, mm-hmm. written about the 1930s. But also they're written in, you wouldn't call it literary fiction, you know, or literary nonfiction. It really is sort of Saturday Evening Postie. They all end with a single paragraph that wraps it all up. You know, there's a moral to the story. The moral to the story often is like, everything's horrible. On to the next thing. It's a super white world. You know, like it's a product of its time. But I also got the sense like these were written for the radio. Like just like you had said, Ryder. Like these were better as performance pieces than essays.
Yes.
And so in a way, it's sort of like Garrison Keillor. Like, oh, Garrison Keillor was charming until you found out what a fucking scumbag he was, you know?
So this was an interesting read. I assumed I would just love it because I love the narration of A Christmas Story so much. And I knew it was pretty word for word. But there were elements here where I was like, from an essayist point of view. And like individual observations are super funny. Like the structures are really cool. Like I like the way that the individual flashback stories are told. But this structure where you're seeing him as an adult, like it really makes clear what is great about this kind of writing and what's bad about this kind of writing. So he's so much better at focusing this laser beam on childhood than during the adult sections, you're like, I do not like this person. You know, they're judgy.
Yeah.
Like the first thing that happens, and of course, totally from a 2020 point of view, but the first thing that happens in the entire thing is he's just like rails against this lady for not wanting toy guns to exist.
Yeah.
Like it's
and rails
so
against California, no less.
Mean. Yeah. And I feel like I've read so many criticisms of essayists being mean. You know, that's a common complaint about David Sedaris. It's a common complaint about David Foster Wallace, etc. But I think if you're writing in this style, whether he claims it's fiction or not, whatever, you have to be super aware of is your judgment going so far that you seem like a humongous asshole, even if you own it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And there's points where I'm like, ugh, I don't like this observation or this generalization, like generalizing about a kid world, saying like all kids are like tearing through Christmas presents with pure avarice. Like that's really fun.
Right.
Apply that as an adult to an adult. That seems like he hasn't learned. He hasn't grown up enough to, you know, apply generosity to people who are unlike him. And that leaves a taste. And there was one line that popped out. I mean, this is really dated, but like really offensive about gay people. Did you guys catch this?
No.
It's the weirdest paragraph I've ever read in my life. Yeah. I cannot figure out what is going on in that paragraph.
Which
essay? It's
thing about
Lolita. A masculinity thing, as Ryder was talking about earlier.
It's this weird quote about Lolita.
Oh, yeah.
That like, I was trying to wrap my head around, like, what is going on?
Yeah,
in this?
That was really strange.
Yeah.
All right, yeah, it's like life when you're a male kid is what the grown-ups... Wait, life when you're a male kid is what the grown-ups are doing. The adult world seems to be some kind of secret society, blah, blah, blah. Okay, the next paragraph. Girls somehow seem to be already involved, as though from birth they've got the word. Lolita has no male counterpart. It does no good to protest and pretend otherwise. The fact is inescapable. A male kid is really a kid. A female kid is a girl. Some guys give up early in life, surrender completely before the impassable transparent wall, and remain little kids forever. They are called fags or homosexuals if you are in polite society.
That is so messed up.
What is happening here? Like, hold on. Lolita has no male counter. So it's like basically because young girls are desirable to dirty old men.
Yeah.
That girls are somehow already in the world of adulthood, which makes them better equipped to deal with it. Whereas boys,
but if you're like, if you're gay, it's okay. Right. If you're molested,
right? Because if you're gay, then you're a Lolita. Yeah, like, what?
Christ.
Yeah, it's so weird. Like I was like, that's just a college like PhD dissertation. You can just be unpacking that paragraph and what the hell is going on in Gene Shepard's head. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of for me, what ended up kind of redeeming a lot of Gene Shepard's nasty point of view and cynicism, which is what I feel like you're nailing, Julia, is that it points in two very clear directions. And, you know, because he shows up in the beginning of the book, he shows up in Indiana and he's immediately judgy of all the people mm-hmm. there. Like, yeah. he's immediately like, look at these sad sacks going to their shitty jobs, making no money, living horrible lives. Like, that's the perspective. And I had a really hard time with that. I was like, ugh. But then you have to realize, like, and it takes a little while to gain steam, but he's equally railing against what he considers the sort of New York effete artists.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the snobbery of, like, other writers, you know? Like, I love that passage. There's a point where he's like, you know, no one in my family ever talked like an Edward Albee play.
Yeah, that's a great moment.
Yeah, it clarified a lot for me. Yeah, and he says, he's like, no one is a Tennessee Williams, you know, in my family. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, my father never screamed, damn it, woman, you're emasculating me.
Right.
He's like, my dad didn't know what emasculating meant, let alone that it was happening to him. You know, and it's like that clarified a certain, like, thing for me, which is he's stuck in between, right? Like, he as a narrator is criticizing both the highfalutin and intellectuals and people who take themselves too seriously on one side, and then the people who never think about their lives critically, who are just, you know, drunks in a mill town, basically, stuck and back in Indiana. And that is, like, it's a tough position, because, like, well, then who are your people, man? Like, because I don't really identify with either, or like, I don't know. It's like this weird in-between zone that he's trying to occupy.
And this is sort of my point about the Main Street USA. Like, when people think about nostalgic Americana of, like, literally make America great again, they're talking mm-hmm. about this period of America.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
You know, when men were men and women cooked and children wanted guns and there was no comp to Lolita. You know, if you weren't raping small children, then you were gay or something like that. You know, and no one's ever going to talk like they're inside of a play. Like, that is what we have been fighting against. You know, this theory that when America was great was this period when we allowed people to be racist and sexist and all these things.
Yes.
But where, you know, we're walking towards innovation. We're just about to enter the space age. We're just coming through the atomic age. Like, all these things were happening that, you know, the greatest generation. Well, the greatest generation was also filled with people coming back from a war where they had no way to deal with it and ended up, you know, creating a widespread series of abuses and alcoholism. You know, like there are all these other things that were going along with it. And so the movie version of A Christmas Story, I find more subversive because it shows you very clearly, like, oh, this is not right. Like, it is actually a better response to the writing than the writing itself was, because it's mocking Americana at the same time as it also makes you feel warm for this idea of family and all that other stuff.
Yeah, for me, a good point of comparison to highlight that is Home Alone, mm-hmm. which I've also mm-hmm. watched with Indy and he loves. And I mean, I hate that movie. I've always hated Home Alone. And to, like, watching it again, I just, like, my hatred gets even more calcified, because it's sort of like in, you know, in A Christmas Story, there's a fantasy sequence of him protecting his family with a BB gun.
Right.
That is just hysterical. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, it's because it's so absurd. Home Alone is that fantasy sequence. Like, Home Alone basically celebrates a sociopathic kid, you know, and his right to defend his house with a gun as, like, a funny, like, let's laugh at this. And it's horrifying. Whereas, you know, I feel like A Christmas Story is just dripping with irony and cynicism, and it is like fantasies within a fantasy to mercilessly mock Americans who want these guns and these fireworks and this kind of, and whereas, like, you know, for me, like, the John Hughes humor from, like, the 80s into the 90s, like, that suburban worldview is just so shockingly limited to me and, like, very, very unself-aware.
John Hughes's humor has not held up, it turns out.
It really doesn't.
It really does not.
Well, you know, it's like, he's a good writer. Like, obviously he can structure a story and tell an amazing story and come up with it. And it's so popular, but it's just like, when you look at the house in Home Alone, you see how big it is. I'm like, who is this written about? Who are these, like, 18-person households of white people. Like, and how are we supposed to relate to this? Yeah. Like, this is crazy talk. But it really worked. Like, for whatever reason, it became the fantasy for an entire generation of, like, white suburban American kids. Like, it's, but it really, it's, that is way more disturbing to me. Like, the sort of, like, the hermetic, like, enclosure that is created by the John Hughes world is really more dangerous to me than something like this, which, you know, obviously Christmas Story has, like, weirdly racist moments with the, you know, the waiters at the end, and there's obviously sexism, and this book has even more of that. But in a weird way, it feels more sort of self-probing, like it feels more self-reflective, and like he's not settled himself. Like Gene Shepard sounds like he was probably a mess because he doesn't really quite know, like, you know, but he's at least he's exploring it in a way that I think is somewhat productive and instructive.
So what I think, when I think, having only seen the movie a few times, when I think about it, to me it's about, it's a coming of age story, but not coming of age in like a sexual way or independence way. It's a coming of age of realizing like this world is fucking bullshit. It's all marketing. It's all disappointing. Like life is disappointing.
It's all
that's the message.
It's all a commercial.
Yeah,
it's all a commercial.
Exactly. And I think that is, that's an amazing subject for essays. It's an, and it's so well connected. It's like he struck the right age, the right stories. Like he was able to draw up those feelings of being let down and like Santa, you know, he's probably not real, but you're not going to take any chances. Like that exact borderline of, do I believe in this world? Do I have hopes and dreams? Do I think everything's going to work out? Or is it all just complete bullshit?
Right.
And that's so perfect. And Home Alone has none of that. Like most Christmas movies have none of that. In fact, they have the opposite. They have, you think it's all bullshit, but it's all real.
Exactly.
Right. And I'm trying to think, like, what's my favorite Christmas movie? A Christmas Story, I've seen, I've probably seen Christmas Story 200 times.
Yeah.
My favorite Christmas movie might be You've Got Mail, which is just as fantastical as this is.
Wow, I haven't seen You've Got Mail since it came out, so I have no idea.
By far my favorite. Every year I gather up a group of friends, not this year, of course. And we go to this old movie theater and see It's a Wonderful Life together. And I'm so, I love that movie so much. I don't know how many times you guys have seen it, but.
I've never seen it.
Julia, you know that he wrote It's a Wonderful Life, Frank Capra did, like 5 minutes from my house at the La Quinta Resort. And every Christmas time they turn the La Quinta Resort into, what's it called? The town.
I'm coming next
so cool.
year. Bedford Falls.
Yeah, they turned turn La Quinta Resort into Bedford Falls. And then it's just a great time spent thinking about banking.
So similarly, It's a Wonderful Life. You got to watch it, Ryder. I'd love to know what you think. It's really about life being a major disappointment.
Yes, it's a horrible movie.
That's what it is. That's what it's about. And it's so... Like, the conclusion, which I will not describe, although I'm sure you've seen it parodied a million times.
I don't think you needed spoiler alert, It's a Wonderful Life.
Who knows?
Is this the one where he comes home and he's like, kids, and he's running around like...
Yes, but
he's
been through
a
lot. It's kind of like...
It's Scrooge, right?
I mean, it's a lot like A Christmas Carol.
Christmas
Carol,
okay.
But it's much darker, and he doesn't actually end up getting what he wants, ever. And so it's very moving, because... You are, if you're someone who feels like you had big dreams and you never did them, like, this is the movie for you.
Right. Doesn't everybody feel that way?
Yeah. Then this is, it's really one of my favorites. I also rewatched The Nightmare Before Christmas this year, which I've seen like 100 times. But that is the best movie ever about cultural appropriation.
Oh, right, because he's trying to take on Christmas. That's so funny.
That's exactly what it is.
That movie is bonkers as far as the actual script. Yeah. It's like, it's a successful, like, it works because the music is great and the sequences are incredible. But when you actually follow the plot, it makes no sense.
Well, have you watched any of the
Claymation?
It's like a
20-minute movie.
Any of the Claymation Christmas movies that we love, they don't make any sense. None of them make any sense.
Rudolph is pretty great, but... No, Nightmare Before Christmas, we watched it around Halloween time, and I was like, this movie's kind of, it's thin, but it's still great. It's so great.
I'm a fan of the Santa Claus. I gotta tell you, I'm a fan of Santa Claus.
That movie is horrible. I just watched it for the first time.
Go watching Santa Claus 2. Just watch the OG. I'm a fan. I'm a fan of the Santa Claus. I like the Rudolph movies. I like all the Santa claymation. I like Burl Ives singing Holly Jolly Christmas as a puppet. I like all that.
Greg
shit.
Yesterday went back in the Wayback Machine. Hopefully, listeners know what that is, where you can find anything ever on the internet. And found this like insane claymation special from 1987. I want to say that was like, it's so weird. I don't even know how to describe it. It's like animals and then weird little sketches about like Quasimodo. Very strange, like pre robot chicken. Mm-hmm. Really weird. We enjoyed it.
What's it called?
And then of course,
I don't remember.
There's the Star Wars Christmas, which Ryder got me into.
Oh, Star Wars Christmas special, which they did. Lego has like a new version of it. They're basically taking the idea of a Star Wars Christmas special and continuing it because of that old classic. Oh, this is hysterical.
So many good
ones. So why do we think Gene Shepard isn't like a household name beyond A Christmas Story?
Probably that Lolita passage.
it's a bad one.
No,
I don't know. Go for it, Julia.
I think it's because of everything we've been talking about. I think he probably created so much of this nostalgic American voice that somehow the culture adopted it as like an everyman voice and everyman story. And then his voice just became part of the air.
Right.
Not like this is one guy's point of view. It's weird that we don't know him, but there's a lot of these magazine writers from this period that we don't know anymore.
Yeah. All those
magazine writing should be, it should be better remembered, but somehow it has vanished.
And, I don't think A Christmas Story was a hit upon release.
No, it was very modest.
Yeah.
It basically
took off in the VHS era. And then, when TNT or TBS or whoever it was started playing it 24 hours a day, like in the late 90s or something like that on Christmas. I think the other thing is that he's not peculiar. He's writing things that are interesting and amusing, but they don't stand out because they're not unusual. Something like Sedaris, he was unusual because, of course, he was combining fiction and nonfiction, quite frankly, with also performance. He was doing all that stuff on This American Life. And so, writers like him and Sarah Vowell and the late David Rakoff, may he rest in peace, a wonderful man, they were writing these stories that were also performance pieces. And that really set them apart, but it also ended up, transforming nonfiction into something like The Moth. There's a very clear line from This American Life to The Moth and all of these storytelling series that happen around the world. And he's the reason behind it. But Gene Shepard, his kind of writing, that kind of storytelling of the sort of, Rockefeller world of yore, I think is just sort of, it was standard American writing. It didn't stand out.
Well, I think like Sedaris too is so much clearer. Like every Sedaris essay is like, I am crazy.
Yes.
Let me show you how crazy I am.
Right.
And then like he's the crazy one. He's the one with the problems or the obsessions. And whereas I feel like Gene Shepard is less clear about that.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, it's harder to pinpoint where he falls. Like, who are you criticizing here? Where does the cynicism stop? And, in some ways it makes it kind of more honest maybe, or more like true to how he actually was. But it's a little harder to nail down like, where to fall. I really appreciated later in the book when all the poverty stuff came to the forefront.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he has that story that is not, to me, funny at all. I don't even know what is funny about it, about the family
the
that Bumpuses got evicted.
Yeah.
The Kohlers, but what's crazy, Kissels.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the Kissels are this family. It's a whole story about how the Kissels got evicted and all their stuff was sold at auction in the neighborhood. And what's crazy to me is that he and Flick in the present tense are looking at each other and they're like both terrified still about this event that happened. It's like economic terrorism that, they're like suffering PTSD for. And then there's another great story. This is about the movie theater in town. And it's all about, like, the movie theater did this plate giveaway where they would give away dishes to wives if they came to the movies on Saturday night. And it was like this, and it was just mind-boggling to me that, like, stuff like this existed, you know, during the Depression, that there was all these weird ways to just try and make a buck or try and provide for your family. And I wish that he had sort of leaned in a little more to that earlier, or that all the stories were sort of more obviously about, like, I don't know, a perspective that I can identify with or be.
But here's the thing, though, is like, he's writing this about a past that everyone shared. Right. So he's writing this.
I guess that's the assumption, that everybody shares it, is the part that's weird for me.
Right.
Yeah. Like,
so it's like, are you going to want to read a bunch of essays about the pandemic? You know, probably not. And yeah. So when you think about it, like, oh, he's writing about the shared nostalgia or the shared horror of this time. A lot of people experience that same thing. You know, right. What's that like? So, you know, I understand the desire, but I think too that, you're looking at it from 60 years after it happened.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think the equivalent to this moment in history, which is so interesting, and I've been thinking about this a lot, is I've been watching a lot of these, like, fuck 2020 wrap-ups and, like, little songs and skits, and I have an endless YouTube appetite for clicking on stuff like that. Call it a comedic interest. But basically, we're agreeing right now culturally on, like, what the story is, like, right. What 2020 was. And the current agreement, which is baking, like, this is getting really baked in, is that everyone in America stayed in their house and baked bread and did all this shit and is getting the vaccine. Like, this is the story that we're building, late night show by SNL skit, one thing at a time. When really right. That is not true. You know, that a lot of people have done the opposite of that, but a lot of people are in, like, a gray area, right. Where they've done some of those things and not others due to various level of privilege, obligation, and choice. But, you know, we're agreeing on what the everyman story is, because for this period of history, just like in the Depression, we're like, well, we're all kind of going through the same thing, which is true on a certain level, and on another level it isn't. So this is a similar time, and I think people will write about it too much, make too many movies about it, and we'll see what the story is.
Yeah.
So the more important question, I think, is as we head toward Christmas, and listeners, you might well be listening to this on Christmas morning, we don't know, what was the thing that you wanted for Christmas that you never got?
Oh.
Ryder, what was that thing that you wanted and never got? And it could be more than one thing.
I don't really remember, honestly.
Oh, I have a list.
I'm trying to think. You know, like, I remember pretty early on, like, being sad by asking for something and getting it for Christmas. Do you know what I mean? Like, just be, like, the anti-climax.
I do not know what you mean.
Okay, sorry. Well, you know, my parents, like, they gave me, you know, like, I remember being like, I remember wanting, the big thing that I really wanted was a drum machine, which was, like, basically an early synthesizer, you know, like, but they were really expensive. Yeah. And my parents, I remember it was my mom being like, right, because I wanted to be a drummer. I was, like, taking drum lessons. I was probably 8 or 9. And you know, somehow I found out that there was a thing called a drum machine where you could make your own beats. And I remember just, like, pleading with my mom being like, we are not getting this for you unless you are serious about drumming and that this actually helps you. You know, it was a lot of that. And of course, Christmas came, that was my present. I got it. And that was all I got, which, fair enough. It was like a $500 or $600 thing. And I remember crying because it was the only present I got. And then, of course, I never used the thing.
Oh, God.
So it was filled with all this shame of, like, why did I ask for such a stupid present that I never, you know, and I, of course, never really became a drummer. Oh my God.
Yeah.
So me, Christmas, that's the memory that I'm like, you know, like, I just think, like, Christmas is wrapped up in a lot of shame and guilt for asking for that drum.
I gotta tell you, Ryder, I've known you for, like, 20 years at this point. I have never heard you mention your desire to be a drummer.
Oh, yeah.
I know more about your desire to be a wolf than I do about your desire to be a drummer.
That's why the same time. Yeah. I transitioned from wanting to be a werewolf to wanting to be a drummer. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, man. I wanted to be a wolf, too. And so, therefore, the thing that I always wanted but never got was a dog. I was, like hardcore campaign for a dog for probably 5 or 6 years in a row. And I've still never had my own dog.
Oh, my gosh.
And I love dogs, but now I'm, like, just a solid cat person, and that's that. But in my family, to Ryder's point, like, it is not, we don't ask for specific things for Christmas. It's like a free-for-all of guessing and shenanigans and flub-dubs, as we like to call them. So I find it more fun to be like, I got, 1 year I got all my cousins and my siblings sweaters with cats on them. I was like, it's the year of cat sweaters. Have at it. And it is a blast, but it's a very different philosophy than, like, here's my list. Please check it off.
So, yeah, you guys, I don't know how you guys were living. I had a list and I was wanting stuff. And so,
always
like,
disappointed.
We'd get the Sears Wish Book. Do you guys know what the Sears Wish Book is?
No.
So, it used to be that every year at Christmas time, Sears would put out this catalog, and I swear to God, it was like 900 pages long. Actually, now that I think about it, I did an episode of our friend Rolf Potts' show. We went to grad school with Rolf, if you guys don't know, of Rolf Potts' show, where we talked about the Sears wish list. So they put out this catalog, and it's like 900 pages long, and it's everything from like tractor trailers to toys. And a lot of the toys are like ersatz branded toys, like instead of like a really nice stereo, it'd be the Sears brand stereo, or instead of like a polo shirt, it's like a guy on a donkey shirt, or you know, whatever it might be. And like I would fold down the pages of the Sears wish book of the stuff that I wanted. But the thing that I really wanted year after year after year that I did not get, and I'm talking like I want to say like 7 years in a row, was a Tyco Night Glow racetrack with the loop de loops. Never got it. Never got it. I don't know why my mom thought I shouldn't have something electrified that lived in my room.
Saved you from burning down the house. Yeah.
Saved me from burning down the dog, the house, everything. Oh my God, I so wanted that Tyco racetrack. But the thing that I've come to understand is like, you never heard other kids saying like, I got that Tyco and it was the truth, man. Like that was great. So it must have sucked. Because otherwise, all your friends would have been talking about it.
Well, on the opposite end of the spectrum, one thing I do know that I asked for and I got was an American Girl doll. And that's still a thing. They're the best. Best of the best. And girls were serious
about their
American
Girl. Are you going to get Vega an American doll? American Girl doll?
I totally will. We should read American Girl. I have a lot of opinions about American Girl.
Is it
mostly positive?
A biography of Tom Petty?
we can read that too. I also love Tom Petty.
These are dolls that you sort of like adopt as little people and then dress up. Or are these dolls like they're doll versions of you? How does it work? Like what's
the
whole...
So when we do our episode on this later, because now that I've brought this up, the readers will not rest until we do this. American Girl is this doll brand. The dolls are really high quality, so they're expensive, which is why they're a coveted item. But the original like group of dolls, there was like three or four, and they're all from a different historical era, and they all have these little books that go with them about basically social justice. They're social justice dolls. But then they were bought out. The company was bought by Mattel, and then Mattel had they turned it into this empire where you could get a doll that looks like you, that's which was amazing for sales, that's but it's sort of
creepy as hell.
Like you lose the idea of the historic dolls, but the historic dolls are still there. And there are many, many more. So there's like, my favorite doll was a Victorian era doll. And her best friend worked in a sweatshop, you know.
Whoa,
this is why I want to read them.
Did I pass out for a minute? Did you say that you have a doll and its best friend works in a sweatshop?
Yes. Everyone who's read a Samantha book knows exactly what I'm talking about. So we will read them because all of them have this angle to them.
Wow.
Although they're not
there's
presented.
There's the doll who sold her hair for $5. The doll...
And they go
sold
up to
the
now.
Fillings in her teeth on the street.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Every joke that I was about to say would have actually got me canceled.
All right. Well, good thing you have restraint.
I am now deeply invested in this entire American Girl thing. Universe. And have to read the books. Are they at all tied into Tom Petty? Like, did Tom Petty create the name and then people started making toys because of the Tom Petty song?
Yes, that's exactly what happened.
Literary Disco is produced and edited by Justin Alvarez for Lit Hub Radio. You can reach out to us directly on Twitter @LiteraryDisco. Happy reading, everybody. Thanks for listening.